sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi David Wolpe, author of Why Faith Matters, and one of the most influential rabbis in America. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Morel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. For the past few weeks, we've been hearing a great deal about U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's fervent negotiations towards a final status agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and the countervailing efforts being made to delegitimize Israel through the boycott, divestment, and sanction movements. We have also heard a lot about Israeli settlements that are being built up with additional housing units authorized regularly, and it all can become rather confusing as a series of seemingly disconnected issues are linked into a messy public relations stew. I think it's worthwhile this morning on Two Jewish breaking all this down into bite-sized pieces, clarifying what can be a confusing set of, well, challenges. First, John Kerry has made more progress than anyone ever expected at a time when nothing seemed to point to any reason for movement at all on the Israeli-Palestinian question. That's to his credit. He's got the two sides talking again after a hiatus of something like, I don't know, 4 years, and has begun a process that might actually lead to some tangible gains in a variety of areas. It is surprising, since the only movement in Israeli-Palestinian relations in a number of years has been backwards. Perhaps the secret was that he had created such low expectations that seeing forward movement at all has been slightly amazing. Secondly, the so-called BDS movement, which is a variety of attempts to villainize and discredit Israel through international boycotts of Israeli scholars and Israeli companies, products, and services, an attempt to encourage financial institutions, pension funds, religious organizations, university, governments, and other entities to divest from investments in Israeli companies, and to sanction Israel in international bodies and organizations, well, it's all been working very steadily for years. While most of the efforts to create boycotts, sanctions, and divestment have failed, a few have succeeded, and the advocates of this are never dissuaded by failures in individual attempts at BDS. Typically, if they try to delegitimize Israel and fail in one area or at one meeting or conference, they come right back and try again somewhere else or the next year at the same conference. The BDS is a movement that is not greatly hampered by any allegiance to truth or accuracy, or even the ideals it supposedly is advocating for. For example, the efforts to delegitimize Israeli academics have been based on the concept of freedom of speech and academic freedom. And there is probably not a single place in the world in which those values are upheld more highly than Israel. In fact, there is not a place in the Arab world that has more academic freedom or as much freedom of speech for Arab academics as they have in Israel itself. But the movement to attack Israel is based on a knee-jerk belief that Israel's presence in the West Bank and even in its own capital of Jerusalem, frankly, in the Middle East at all, is somehow morally wrong, and therefore Israel itself must be demonized systematically, regardless of the facts. Unfortunately, the BDS movement is now making some headway with large European financial institutions, which will definitely impact Israel's robust economy negatively. Third, we regularly hear about the announcement of new construction by Israel in occupied territories, quote-unquote, and are told that these are provocative acts. In fact, most of the construction taking place and being so roundly criticized by international organizations, and of course the Arabs, is happening in neighborhoods around Jerusalem that were annexed to Israel in 1967. In any final settlement agreement, these neighborhoods and suburban cities like Maale Adumim or Pisgat Zev will certainly be retained by Israel. It's true that some accommodation will certainly need to be made, land swaps and the like. In earlier, almost successful negotiations with the Palestinians that could have resulted in a full-on Palestinian state over 20 years ago, Israel offered the Palestinians about 93% of all the land in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, which moved almost all the Jewish residents on the Arab side of the so-called Green Line into the State of Israel. That's right, about maybe 7%. Lest we forget, it was the Palestinians who rejected that deal and began a campaign of terror that destroyed their own best hope of becoming a true nation. I still believe it would be best if Israel did not suddenly approve tons of new housing every time John Kerry visits the Middle East. But I also think it doesn't really matter and isn't material to the ultimate resolution of this problem. My own hope, my hatikva, if you will, is that this time the Palestinians have learned from their many mistakes and that a middle to right-wing Israeli government holds together and embraces what looks like a real opportunity for peace. May it be both of their wills, Israeli and Palestinian alike, and may especially it be God's will, because it will likely take a bit of divine help to make it happen. To play us in this morning on this theme, here's a lovely prayer for peace for Israel, the country, and our people, called Shalom Rav, sung by Armon Mizman, the new Jewish rock band featuring Sam Golden and Bob Hanshaw.
Shalom Rav Yisrael, Amcha Tasim Leolam. Shalom Rav Yisrael, Amcha Tasim Leolam. Shalom Rav Yisrael, Amcha Tasim Leolam. Shalom. Amcha tasim le'olam, ki ata hu melech adom, lecho ha'shalom, ki ata hu melech adom, lecho ha'shalom, shalom rav Yisrael. Amcha tasim le'olam, shalom rav Yisrael. Amcha tasim le'olam, v'torinecha levarech et amcha Yisrael. Bechol et uvechosha Shalom Rav Yisrael, Amcha Tasim Le'olam. Shalom Rav Yisrael, Amcha Tasim Le'olam. Tasim Le'olam, Tasim Le'olam.
That was Shalom Rav, a prayer for peace for Israel by Armon Mizman. Rabbi David Wolpe is the rabbi of Sinai Temple in Los Angeles, one of the flagship congregations of the entire conservative movement in America. Newsweek magazine has called him the most influential rabbi in America. And we'll ask him about that and talk with him in a few moments when we return here on Too Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics. academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish this morning Rabbi David Wolpe. He's been named the most influential rabbi in America by Newsweek magazine. By the way, how does that feel?
It feels illegitimate, but fun.
That's such a Jewish answer. I don't think I deserve it, but I like it.
Exactly.
He has also been named one of the 50 most influential Jews in the entire world by the Jerusalem Post. He's the rabbi of Sinai Temple, one of the flagship conservative synagogues in Los Angeles, California. He's previously taught at Jewish Theological Seminary, the American Jewish University. In fact, he taught there when it was the University of Judaism, which is actually when I first met him, Hunter College and UCLA. He writes for many publications. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's make it a nice, simple question. What's the most important issue facing the American Jewish world today?
Although this may seem evasive, I will say there are two simultaneous issues. One is spiritual disappearance, and the other is the maintenance of a strong Israel.
Many American Jews are well acquainted with all of the different lobbies working on behalf of Israel, AIPAC to J Street and many others. We hear about Israel quite a lot. Let's talk about spiritual disappearance. What do you mean by that?
By that, I mean that the Jewish literacy, Jewish concern, Jewish involvement, all of those have suffered tremendously over the years. And without a concerted effort by the American Jewish community to revive the essentials of Jewish life, I think, as we see, there will be a gradual ebbing of Jewish life in America, which would be a tragedy.
This is something of a golden age, historically speaking, American Judaism.
Yes.
We have seen a huge amount of effort put forward in a variety of areas. We have more Jewish organizations than probably have ever existed in one place in the world at any one time in history, maybe combined. What kind of organizations are well situated to try to revive Jewish spiritual life?
Well, certainly synagogues are crucial in this endeavor, although not only synagogues. I think if you had to name one thing that was the most important, I think it would be Jewish education. Most Jews are Jewishly fairly illiterate. They don't know a lot about Jewish history or Jewish spiritual learning. And as a result, what you get is a generation that, even though they may feel Jewish or have an emotional attachment to Judaism, don't entirely understand what it means to be Jewish.
Is it possible to be just Jewish for several generations?
It is possible, I would say, to care about Judaism for a generation or two, but it's remarkable how quickly from one generation to the next things can disappear. And so if you don't teach specific Jewish behaviors, learning and so on, in fact, I think that Judaism can vanish more quickly than our ancestors may have ever suspected. And that's a frightening prospect.
We will talk much more with Rabbi David Wolpe when we come back this morning on Two Jewish.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it, is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country. The only place in the world certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. Word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there or the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is coming June 11th to June 23rd, 2014. If you're interested in going on this fantastic journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat, from the Dead Sea to the Sea of Galilee to Jerusalem, please email TOOJewishRadio, TOOJewishRadio18@gmail.com, or call 520-327-4501 for more information and the itinerary. We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Israel has an interesting situation with migrants now. We talk about Israel's immigrant nation, and the Zionist Jews were going to farm the land and drain the swamps and build the buildings, and they did all of that. But now it's a complex modern economy, and many of those jobs, many of the Israelis are too well educated. They don't want to do that work. There's work to be done, and Israel has brought in various different groups of workers, or they've just come in. Does this present a kind of immigration problem for Israelis?
First, yes. And, you know, there is too many ways to look at this situation, because on one hand, we know that due to the constraints, Israel became more a startup nation. So lots of, you know, energy and
high tech.
And people concentrate on this. And on the other hand, you're right. There became a need for a low tech, or I would say, you know, people to actually work work with the soil. And we also can connect it to the kibbutzim, because the kibbutzim used to do all the agriculture, but the kibbutzim, because of the privatization process, most of the kibbutzim sold their lands, and they are doing mostly high-tech
or textiles or something.
Yeah,
but
so
not
there
that.
Is all kind of mega trends for the last 2-3 decades that influenced and like brought us to this situation of today. And I can also say in a very delicate way that the same as the kibbutzim, like huge, big ideology, like broke down. So I don't say that chas v'chalila, that the ideology of the Zionism broke down. No. But there is a new Zionism, and to build the country is not only to work at with the soil. It's also to be a startup nation. I think it's the most mitkadim, most advanced, you know, Zionism. So anyway, yeah, there is a need of people to help with agriculture and other, and it
domestic chores.
Yeah, and it's
creating
like a trend of immigrants from Thailand, from Philippines, and now from Africa. And now we're dealing with a very, very complex situation in Israel that I don't think it's simple to anyone to say yes or no to leave them or not, because it's really confront us with a very moral question as a Jew, as a Zionist, and as a Jew, and as both of them, and we can see. But I really appreciate the way that at least I can't say the government allow, sorry for the English is like a,
it's fine.
Like the way that there is lots of, if you saw the last rally.
Yeah, there was a bunch of rallies.
I think it was more than a quarter of white people that joined this. It's not,
yeah,
just
lots of Israelis that joined with the
Africans. Lots of Israelis really would like,
right,
to find some balanced solution, because on one hand there is a security of the Israelis and we can't ignore what's happening in Tel Aviv, in Levinsky Garden and other places in Tel Aviv. But on the other hand, we need to find a balanced solution for this. And I know that a lot of organizations and people really working hard to find a solution for this.
Yeah, it speaks well to Israeli society. And, you know, the problem in numbers is tiny compared to America, which has literally millions of undocumented workers, illegal immigrants, mm-hmm. whatever side you fall on the fence there. But still, for Israel, it's a new problem, or a fairly new problem, and one that they're trying to address.
And it's growing very rapidly. So.
Yeah, getting bigger. We will continue to follow it. Thanks, Ashraf.
Yeah, thank you.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, J-E-T-C-O, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. The state of Arizona allows its taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations, who then provide scholarships for kids from kindergarten through 12th grade to attend qualified private schools. JETCO helps provide a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get a 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Tax credit's not a deduction. Your taxes are reduced by the amount you give. Join over 750 supporters last year who donated money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. There's an additional tax credit now, the switcher credit, which increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,031 for single filers, $2,062 for married couples filing jointly. When we are fighting every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, we should all take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to help foster a Jewish identity for our community's children. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive the financial aid they need to receive a good Jewish education. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, call 520-647-8442, again 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of education.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, we've been hearing for years, it seems like a decade, Iran is about to go nuclear and they're going to use an atomic weapon on Israel, and we should all be terrified about this imminent disaster. Remember Netanyahu at the UN with a big picture of a bomb with a line drawn across the middle of it. Do we worry too much?
Well, I mean, I think the answer is, yeah, not only Jews, but Jews certainly are among the champions. We all tend to worry too much. And governments tend to prey on our fearfulness and also on our ignorance. So you'll recall in the not very distant past, we went to war to remove a dictator who was supposedly sitting on hundreds, if not thousands, of weapons of mass destruction.
WMDs.
Right.
In Iraq,
and it turned out when
Hussein.
We went in there at huge expense and loss of life and whatever, couldn't find a single one. Fancy that. It was all a hoax. So I think that governments also often try to justify conclusions they've already reached or decisions to alter foreign policy or to engage in aggressive activity based on fear-mongering. So with Iran, for, as you just pointed out, quite a long time, we've been told that they're 3 months away from acquiring full nuclear capability. And we've been hearing that for 5-10 years. And of course, the one state in the region that really has to worry about that, although certainly not the only state, because of the Shiite-Sunni divide and because the Saudis have very different objectives and they're terribly afraid of Iran becoming nuclear. The Turks would be none too happy either, although they're under the NATO umbrella, so they would theoretically be protected. But the Israelis, you know, they're a Jewish state, they're a small state. They do have nuclear capacity, and they would use it in an eventual exchange with Iran. And that would have devastating consequences, not only for the region, but for world peace, if Iran actually has nuclear weapons, which nobody has satisfactorily demonstrated. So, I mean, I don't want to say that the whole thing is a tempest in a teapot. And I think a regime that gets an agreement from Iran, which is verifiable, to stop progress towards becoming nuclear capable is de facto a good agreement, even if it means lifting economic sanctions, making people a little less miserable in Iran. If it's going to result in verifiable steps to limit the development of nuclear weapons and to avoid adding yet another country to the list of countries which are capable of using nuclear weapons, that's a good thing. I mean, an even better thing and something worth celebrating is how much active disarmament there has been in long-established nuclear powers of reducing nuclear weapons and nuclear capacity. Because for a long time, both the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and then also England and France, at the very least, were nuclear-capable. None of them ever used a nuclear weapon. There were tests in the South Pacific. There were tests in the Nevada Desert. But nobody ever used one in warfare. And there was this kind of balance of terror and a theory of mutual deterrence.
Bad, mutually assured destruction, right?
That prevented nuclear weapons from being used. And the shorter the list of countries that are nuclear capable, the easier it is to rely on that kind of a doctrine and on verifiable disarmament and control programs. As the list gets longer and some countries have less responsible leadership, the risk grows. Whether it's a risk to Israel or to us or anybody else, a nuclear exchange would be bad for the world.
Well, we certainly hope that that never occurs and that Iran doesn't have nuclear capacity, but it's wise, obviously, to take all of the reports with a bit of a couple of grains of salt. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. And a classic this week, although I just hope it's not too visual for radio. 75-year-old Jaime is not looking as he crosses the street and gets hit by a car. He's lying in the road, and a priest who sees the accident runs over to help. Just in case it was serious, the priest begins to administer last rites. "No thanks, Father," Jaime says. "I'm not a Catholic." "What, you're not a Catholic?" says the priest. "So why did you make the sign of the cross after the car hit you?" And Jaime replies, "What sign of the cross? Nah, I was just checking." "Checking?" says the priest. "Checking for what?" "Everything important to me. Spectacles, testicles, wallet, and watch." You see, if you see somebody doing that, they touch their one pocket and the other pocket and down below and... never mind. Anyway, that was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and don't get hit. And now a word of Torah. In Shakespeare's great play Julius Caesar, Cassius says famously, "The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves." I always think of that quotation when I explore this week's Parsha. We read the Torah portion of Ki Tisah this week, the story of the golden calf. It's one of the most dramatic and, for the rabbis of the Talmud, distressing parts of the whole Torah. The problem is acute. According to the text of Torah, our people witnessed the 10 plagues, are personally saved at the shore of the Sea of Reeds by God, receive the direct revelation at Sinai, in short, experience God more directly than any other people in history ever has. And then, almost immediately, they turn around and reject God and worship a cow made out of their own jewelry. No wonder the rabbis of the Talmud and Midrash called this week's events the Maaseh HaEgel, the awful tale of the calf. How can a people given such a clear set of wonders and signs, and even direct instruction and command, only follow God for 40 days before pursuing a weak and bovine substitute? The answer, to paraphrase Shakespeare, is not in our God, but in ourselves. We enjoy spectacle, are impressed by it, even awed by it. But as soon as it's gone, its effects linger a very short time indeed. What makes us tick as human beings, what keeps us in line, is the very dailiness of regular observance, of rules and schedules, of the kinds of laws and rituals that are very much a part of practical Judaism in subsequent periods. We need both ritual and structure, and until both of these are provided in a coherent way, we tend to flounder, even disastrously so, as we did at the time of the golden calf. The message is simply that we need more than grand ideas or sweeping spirituality. We need religion and a Jewish grounding in practice and experience, or we won't be able to remain both ethical and coherent. Without that focus, we begin to worship golden calves of every kind, our work or our pastime, our possessions or our unfortunate obsessions with power or control or validation. The antidote to this tendency to turn to substitutes for goodness is to renew our commitment to holy actions, even small ones. This week, try to incorporate a Jewish practice you have not previously done, a bit of Torah study or prayer or ritual or tzedakah that you haven't made a regular part of your life previously. Doing this will help you connect to the true God, and so avoid the danger of worshiping your own golden calves. When we come back on 2 Jewish, our guest, Rabbi David Wolpe, will explore what influence means and the current state of conservative Judaism. Stay with us when we return on 2 Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114. We continue with our 2 Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israel has offered Turkey $20 million in compensation to the families of the 9 Turkish nationals killed and wounded during the 2010 Israel Defense Forces raid on the Mavi Marmara. Diplomats say that progress is being made, but there is as yet no agreement. Reconciliation talks between Turkey and Israel, which had petered out for months, were revived in early December when the Turks invited the Israeli negotiating team, National Security Advisor Yossi Cohen, Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu's Special Envoy Joseph Chichenover, and Foreign Ministry Director General Nisim Ben Shitrit to return to Istanbul. During that round of talks, the Turks softened their position and lowered their demands for compensation. Western diplomats say the Turks have demanded $30 million, which was still double the $15 million Israel was originally prepared to pay. In the weeks after the negotiators returned home, Netanyahu held consultations with them and then decided to up Israel's offer to $20 million. Western diplomats say Netanyahu even gave the team permission to go up another $3 million, if necessary, to secure an agreement. It's not clear yet whether Turkey will be willing to show flexibility again in its stance and lower its compensation demands to match that being offered by Israel, but you would think they could come to an even spot. The money will not be paid directly to the wounded or to the families of the dead. It'll be deposited in a humanitarian fund and distributed to the victims in accordance with some defined criteria. Jerusalem does not expect any agreement to be reached before the Turkish local elections March 30th, since Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan is said to fear that an agreement with Israel and a compromise on the compensation will hurt him politically. Israeli officials note that aside from the compensation, which is important to the Turks, a real reconciliation agreement between the countries is also dependent on issues important to Israel that have yet to be concluded. A major issue for Israel is the cancellation of lawsuits against the IDF soldiers and officers involved in intercepting the flotilla. Israel is demanding that, as part of the agreement, Turkey pass a law that will void the pending legal actions and block them in the future. Jerusalem also wants the normalization of relations with Turkey to go beyond the symbolic return of ambassadors to Tel Aviv and Ankara. Israel wants to have its diplomatic dialogue with Turkey resume, ministerial meetings, mutual visits, and other steps. Israel also expects Turkey to commit not to act against Israel in international forums and to stop haranguing Israel in the media as they've been doing. For a long time, Turkey had demanded Israel lift the blockade on Gaza as a condition for normalizing relations. But back in November, Turkish Foreign Minister Ahmet Davutoglu said that the country was satisfied with the altered Israeli policies, which allowed humanitarian goods into Gaza. In terms of Turkish aid and also the others, Israel has opened its doors relatively and contributed to the arrival of the aid in Gaza following a negative stand by Egypt. Our final goal is to finalize the compensation talks and in parallel spend efforts to improve the humanitarian conditions in Palestine, to be followed by steps to eventually lift the embargo. As long as developments take place in this direction, Turkish-Israeli relations will improve, Davutoglu said. The deterioration in relations with Turkey, which started in early 2009 following Operation Cast Lead in Gaza, hit rock bottom in May 2010 after the Mavi Marmara raid. The crisis led to a downgrading of official relations and the eventual expulsion of the Israeli ambassador from Ankara in September 2011. Quite a contrast to the close cooperation and military cooperation Israel and Turkey had evidenced up until 2009. In March of 2013, just a little less than a year ago, during Barack Obama's visit to Israel, the president mediated a phone call between Erdogan and Netanyahu, during which Netanyahu apologized to the Turkish people for the Mavi Marmara incident and agreed with Erdogan to begin a process of normalizing relations. May this rapprochement between Turkey and Israel continue, and all remaining conflicts be resolved soon.
If God would have wanted a rudder, then God would have said, make a rudder. 'Cause God doesn't beat around the bush. He tells you what he thinks. But God didn't mention a rudder, so there ain't gonna be any rudder. Not even if the whole caboodle sinks.
Was Noah's Ark actually a round boat? A recently deciphered 4,000-year-old clay tablet from ancient Mesopotamia is putting a new spin on the biblical tale of the flood and of Noah's Ark. The book of Genesis includes detailed specifications for the giant boat, which all kinds of animals were placed 2x2 and some 7x7, to shelter for 40 days and 40 nights of rain. The wooden ark was supposed to measure about 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 30 feet high. That's 300 by 50 by 30 cubits if you're measuring the old way. All well and good. But the specifications listed on the Babylonian ark tablet, which is now on display at the British Museum, are totally different. The Babylonian boat was supposedly to be made of braided rope, stiffened by wooden spars, and sealed with bitumen. And it was supposed to have a round base measuring 230 feet wide. Really a heart-stopping moment, the discovery that the boat was supposed to be round, said Irving Finkel, who just might be Jewish, a curator at the British Museum. That was a real surprise. A circular ark is in keeping with the look of a coracle, a type of river taxi widely used during ancient times in the region we now call Iraq. But that layout doesn't mesh with what Genesis says, which is taken as word-for-word literal truth in fundamentalist Christian circles. So, which text came first? Finkel says the account of the flood in the Ark was probably passed along to us Jews during the Babylonian exile in the 6th century BCE and served as the basis for the Genesis story. Now, even if you believe that the Torah was given to Moses at Sinai, that only puts it at around 1250 BCE. Biblical Archaeology Review's Noah Wiener says the cuneiform tablet was created a full millennium before the Genesis narrative could have been written down, meaning, well, the Ark may have originally been round. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi David Wolpe. If he's not the most influential rabbi in America, certainly one of the most influential congregational and, I guess, influential rabbis. One of the 50 most influential Jews in the world, according to the Jerusalem Post. David Wolpe is the rabbi of Sinai Temple in Los Angeles, California. He has written widely on a variety of subjects and has 7 books out, including the national bestseller Making Loss Matter, Creating Meaning in Difficult Times. Rabbi Wolpe's book, Why Faith Matters, is a powerful argument in favor of why just that, faith. Welcome back.
Thank you.
In looking at the American Jewish community, which is the most affluent in human history, quite likely, probably the best educated in every area except Jewish learning, what's different about approaching the American Jewish community to encourage a revival of Jewish life?
Well, you point out about how well-educated American Jews are, and this is the source of a sort of paradoxical and painful reality. I mean, there are Jews I know and you know who, you know, if they're going to go to Italy, so they learn Italian in 3 weeks, they're masters of all sorts of arcane fields, but they don't speak a word of Hebrew. They've never opened a serious Jewish book. And part of what I think is essential if we're going to be able to survive as a community is to convince people that, in fact, Jewish learning does and should enjoy the same kind of intellectual prestige and status that general learning does, and that you really can't maintain a Jewish community if Jews don't study and learn the same way they study and learn about other things.
So for a long time it was, we need Jewish day schools and we're going to create a strong Jewish day school network and that's going to make the American Jewish community more Jewish. Day schools are wonderful and they succeed in their way, but they reach really a small percentage of the American Jewish population. What's the next piece? How do we crack this nut?
In addition to Jewish day schools and Jewish camping, which also is a crucial part of this and I think has made tremendous strides in motivating people to live and learn Jewishly, I think that there has to be some sort of generalized sea change in the way that Jews understand the peril of spiritual disappearance, because that's a lot of what's going on, is that there is a genuine possibility that Judaism will disappear. Jews won't disappear, but Judaism will disappear, and people who are Jews will have very little, if any, Jewish concern or activism or influence in the world, which would be, I think, a tremendous tragedy.
You know, I saw among the reports of the fairly recent Pew report, which was the closest we got to a national Jewish population survey for 2010, more people identified Jewish humor as integral to their Jewish identity than halacha, than any kind of observance of Jewish law, meaning that John Stewart has more followers by far than the Lubavitcher Rebbe.
I think we're pointing to exactly right with that question, exactly the point that I'm sort of groping at less articulately than you just did, which is to say, without things that are specifically uniquely Jewish, and jokes aren't, neither is feeding the poor, as essential as that is to Judaism, it's right. Not uniquely Jewish. Without things that are not uniquely Jewish, I think Jewish culture will disappear. Because if it's all about telling jokes and giving charity, well, lots of people can tell jokes and give charity without a specifically Jewish attachment or Jewish content. And that's why the Jewish world, I think, has to place a great emphasis on things that are, in fact, unique to Jewish culture. And as wonderful as John Stewart is, and I enjoy him too, you know, his name could be Chris Rock, and he could still be funny.
Right. What's the best thing about the American Jewish community?
The best single thing, I think, is really their constellation of virtues. They're smart, they're generous, they achieve a lot, they care deeply. I mean, I'm in my own congregation, I must say, this is a congregation that is very privileged. Half of my members come from Beverly Hills. I'm constantly amazed at the degree of their involvement and concern and philanthropy. I mean, the American Jews are a remarkable people. It's one of the reasons why I want to keep them.
You, I only speak from a little bit of experience, too. You come as a from a, I don't want to say a dynasty of conservative rabbis. Talk a little bit about living up to a heritage on a personal basis.
Well, my father, I mean, the dynasty began with my father. My grandfather, actually, his father was a vaudevillian, which may be the same thing.
I think it's the same business. a little less spiritual, but, you know,
exactly.
The jokes are good.
My father was the rabbi of a large conservative synagogue and a wonderful man and a wonderful rabbi. And I suppose...
Look, he had a book written about him, kind of.
Exactly. For me, I think it was, fortunately, because he was so kind and because he was so genuinely encouraging and helpful, I feel more that his example is to me something that spurs me as opposed to intimidates me. I feel very lucky that when I came into the rabbinate, I realized how much I had unconsciously imbibed over the years, because I never thought I was going to be a rabbi. And then when I did, I thought, wow, a lot of this comes naturally to me. I guess I learned more than I thought I learned.
Let's talk a little bit about the conservative movement. It finds itself in an interesting position. For a long time, the middle was the right place to be in American Judaism. It was the, if not the dominant movement, certainly the largest movement. It's not so true anymore. Like many people, I grew up in the conservative movement, and I'm now in the reform movement or somewhere else. What's the future for the conservative movement?
Well, the conservative movement, as you point out, resisted self-definition because it had so many adherents that to define itself was to exclude. As a result, it lacks self-definition. To call yourself the middle is not really to define yourself. And so what I have been pushing for and will continue to push for is that the conservative movement define itself in a positive and powerful way. The way that I like to think of it is the movement of relationship. It's the movement that advocates a close relationship with other Jews, with the non-Jewish world, a continuing dialogue with God, which is why we believe that Jewish law changes. And I think that that's a very powerful self-definition. And if we would be able to move forward with a clear statement of who we are, I think conservative Judaism would do much better. As it is now, we languish in part because people are uncertain. Even if you ask conservative Jews, what is it that conservative Jews believe? Most of them have trouble formulating that answer.
The American Jewish community has been called a non-ideological community, which is an interesting thing. In other words, people choose where they go and what they do based on, as you say, relationships and also proximity and affinities, not so much belief. What does that say for encouraging people to find spirituality?
Let me first give you my pet theory about what's going on with the American Jewish community, and maybe I will be able to back into an answer through that, which is, I think that the reason that liberal movements are having trouble in Jewish life, the conservative movement and to some extent the reform movement, is because, as the old Yiddish saying has it, Jews are like other people, only more so. And what I mean by that is that fundamentalism is on the rise all throughout the world. Christian evangelical fundamentalism, Muslim fundamentalism, and it would be surprising if Jewish right-wing religiosity, Jewish literalism, wasn't also on the rise. So orthodoxy is doing well because orthodoxy, or its equivalent, is doing well in every religion, from Hinduism to Islam to Christianity. But one thing that I do know is that sociological trends change. And that because it's doing well today, it doesn't mean it will be doing well in 10 years or 20 years or 50 years. And so I think that the less rigidly ideological movements, the conservative and reform movements in particular, will do well because the move towards ideology in some of these religions, which is sort of, as you point out, against the American ethos, won't last forever. But the other piece of what you talked about, the proximity piece, is that Jews really do need to try to create organizations, neighborhoods, institutions where they have Jewish summer camps, where they have a lot of contact with one another, because you can't create a family, and that's what Jews are, they're a religious family. You can't create a family if nobody ever talks to each other.
We like to argue. It's sort of in our DNA. And
we do not. Okay.
I disagree.
Exactly. I disagree with that completely.
Kol machlok al shem shamayim. When we see Jewish life move from the area of the kind of arguments that were so common and which led eventually to you are right and you are also right, but they can't both be right, now it seems sometimes we go further than that. And the divisions are sharper. Is that true?
I mean, I see that as well, that it's happening in our political life and it's happening in Jewish religious life. My email is very distressing. The number of emails I get that are vitriolic on both sides, by the way, left and right, both, right. Is really disturbing, because each side seems incapable of crediting the other, not just with being, with having some piece of the truth, but even with good intentions. Each side thinks the other is just venal and evil and wrong. And I think that that's a horrible way, both to look at the world and also to look at other Jews. I think that there's a great deal in Orthodoxy and Reform Judaism that is beautiful and wonderful and that I wish we could learn from. I think that there are people on the left side of the political spectrum that have hold of great important truths and priorities, and people on the right side of the political spectrum that do. And somebody whose mind is so closed that they can't imagine that the other side has hold of anything worthwhile, distresses me, and I think is ultimately going to be destructive.
You were integral in creating with Craig Taubman the Friday Night Live service at Sinai that's spread around. It's part of introducing new and interesting ways of approaching worship and, of course, music in the conservative movement. Is there more to be done?
Oh, there's so much more to be done. It showed how much untapped spiritual potential and hunger and yearning there was in people when people started to flood to these services. Part of it is teaching clergy how to present themselves differently, and part of it is educating people, you know, that institutions can change, and that part of it is the way we've built our synagogues, which somewhat militates against this kind of engaged, intimate service. But that's really what younger people want. They want something that's not staid and distant and formal. And unless we can create services that speak to them, there's no reason in the world why they should want to come and sit as their parents did, with the expectation of being bored for 2 hours out of 2.5 hours, and maybe a half hour of engagement. That was the old pattern, but I think it's not the new one.
I think we could continue this conversation for a long time. I want to thank Rabbi David Wolpe for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about your publications?
I am on both Facebook and Twitter, both at Rabbi Wolpe, and they can also come to the Sinai Temple website, which is just SinaiTemple.org.
Thanks so much. And we continued success. Maybe the next time you speak at a national convention, we'll get a chance to interview you live from there.
I would love that. Thank you.
Thanks so
much.
Thanks so much.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best.
To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Rabbi Rick Jacobs, president of the Union for Reform Judaism, the umbrella organization of all Reform congregations in North America. Our playout this morning comes from Josh Nelson. It's his Yihyu L'Ratzon. May it be your will, God, that the words of my lips and the meditations of my heart be acceptable to you, my rock and my redeemer. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. Beg your